This podcast is sponsored by Canaccord Genuity Wealth Management, award-winning wealth managers who go above and beyond to support and guide you. Visit candowealth.com to start building your wealth with confidence.
Hello and welcome to Coffee House Shots, the Spectator's daily politics podcast. I'm Cindy Yu and I'm joined by Katie Bors and James Forsyth. It's been a bit of a mad day today as people are trying to find out what new countries are added on the green list, spoiler alert, no new countries, and which ones are being taken off the green list. Katie, you've had a particularly stressful and busy day, I would say.
You could say that, Cindy. So I think the announcement for everyone is ultimately, I think we're seeing the fact that the travel industry are not going to like the recent developments in the sense that no countries have been added to the green list. And this was the 3-week review that we were seeing. And there was only one direction of travel, as someone in government put it to me, in the sense that countries are being downgraded. So Portugal, which is, I think, one of two places where at least for a brief period, not only was it on the green list, but they would also let you in, is now moving to amber as of 4 a.m. on Tuesday. Time frame I've been studying closely because I'm supposed to be going to Portugal tomorrow. And then I think when you look at countries being added to the red list, I think Egypt is among countries being added to the red list. So it's very much moving to amber and to red. And I think that there had been a hope a few weeks ago that this would be the point when more European countries, Spain, potentially France, though maybe that was the next month's one, would start to be added and you'd have a wider choice of holiday destinations, where if anything, the complete opposite is happening, which is, I think, those hoping or holding out to book summer holidays abroad are finding that on the current trajectory, the options are going to be very limited. Now, what does this point to? I think it's interesting as we talk about June 21st, because Boris Johnson's often faced pressure, not just from scientists, but from his own cabinet, I think specifically figures such as Matt Hancock, to really clamped down on international travel, and in doing that, allow greater domestic freedom. Is this a hint that following the Indian variant, which has clearly worried the government, they are now going to take a harsher border policy to try and preserve and keep the roadmap on track?
James, is this a sign of things to come? And in some ways, it feels like deja vu of last summer, the sort of red list, green list, amber list game that people are playing? Or is it actually going to be that the summer is more strict than last one?
I think Katie is right. I think if you look at the little kind of clip Grant Shapps did explaining this shift, it is essentially to protect the domestic reopening. They are taking this precautionary step against Portugal. Now, I think in terms of the trade-offs that Boris Johnson is prepared to make, I think he doesn't like closing borders instinctively. But I think if that's what it takes to get rid of the 1 meter rule, I suspect that might be a trade-off he would make. I think there is, I would have a slight question mark about the effectiveness of some of this. Mm. Lots of people cite Australia and New Zealand as examples of how you can keep COVID out with, you know, strict hotel quarantine policies and like. And there's undoubtedly true that there's been some efficacy there. But it is much easier for Australia and New Zealand because nearly all freight coming into the country is unaccompanied. It arrives in crude terms, it arrives on a plane or on a big container ship. While as the UK, most freight is accompanied. You know, it is crossing, not to sound like Dominic Raab, but it is crossing the short strait between Dover and Calais on lorries. And therefore, you have to have any kind of, you almost inevitably have to have exemptions for lorry drivers, at which point you have created some permeability. So this idea of creating this perfect vaccinated COVID-free bubble island and calling it Britain, I'm just sceptical on how achievable that is.
I mean, Katie, if we're trying to make a vaccinated bubble in this country, how long is that going to last for? I mean, that's the pressing question, isn't it? Because it might not be just this summer that we're being strict and protecting our domestic easing. It might be that come autumn, come winter, come early next year, we're thinking actually the rest of the world isn't vaccinated enough and we're just going to keep to ourselves while it lasts.
So I think the argument those in government who support a tightening of international restrictions would make is that this is a temporary measure because ultimately it's down to vaccination and countries are going to become more vaccinated. The UK is currently in the top end in terms of countries that are fast at this, but it is a matter of months, in some cases perhaps a year or so, for other countries to catch up. So it's not the same as Australia and New Zealand in terms of their approach. Like you look at Australia, for example, where there now is some concern, I think, in Victoria over the Indian variant. The number of percentage of the population vaccinated is absolutely tiny, and we don't have that problem here. I think that it only really works as a temporary measure, partly because of our economy, and also the fact that, you know, this isn't just about holidays. So lots of people say, why is, you know, broadcast and so forth dominated with talk of holidays? But actually, we're a very international country, as Fraser has written about many times, in terms of people who have family abroad. And therefore, I generally think even those who support this don't think it is a sustainable long-term solution. When it comes to Matt Hancock's promise repeatedly of a great British summer, always said British, which I think was a very clear indicator that of how he saw this year panning out, they think this is necessary. But again, I think that both in terms of the economy, but also in terms of the Tory parliamentary party, I don't think this is sustainable in terms of the long term. I think in terms of the difficult acute period of the pandemic, lots of Tory MPs will support this in the short term if it brings you something. But I don't think, as James says, we can become like some countries.
And speaking of the Conservative Party, James, we're hearing rumblings that next week the government might lose on a vote about the cut to the foreign aid budget. Can you remind listeners about where this row came from and why it's moving again now?
Okay, so the coalition government legislated to put the 0.7% aid target into law. Government can miss it, but it has to explain to Parliament why, and it can't deliberately intend to miss it. Now, the government has announced that it's cutting aid from 0.7% to 0.5%, but it has not brought a bill to Parliament. And what this amendment that Andrew Mitchell has laid, the former development secretary and also importantly a former chief whip, has laid, it seeks to do is basically to force the government to, after this year's cuts, to go back to 0.7 straight away. And the rebellion's already got 30 Tory MPs signed up to it. It's got Theresa May's backing, Jeremy Hunt, the former foreign secretary's backing, a slew of select committee chairs, a bunch of former ministers. And I think it tells you two things which should worry Boris Johnson and Tory whips. First of all, it is revealing of how many former ministers there are on the backbenches who are basically, on matters that they care about, going to go against the government if they don't agree with the government. Now, normally you'd think you could appeal to these people with a kind of classic don't rot the boat, you owe loyalty to the party. I think that is harder to do. I think if someone went up to Theresa May and tried to say to her, you can't vote against Boris Johnson because, you know, that made life very difficult for him, I think she might point out the number of times he voted against her on Brexit. So I think you've got that problem. The second thing I think this shows is how hard holding the line on spending is going to be. That you've got this is a very rare cut in that most voters support it. Yet even that hasn't been enough to stop a rebellion that is large enough to threaten the government's majority. And then I think the final cause of worry for Boris Johnson and Tory whips is this problem of people on the backbenches who know that they ain't coming back to cabinet anytime soon and are going to do their own thing and do what they consider to be the right thing rather than following the party whip is only going to grow after a reshuffle, because that's going to result in more former ministers sitting on the backbenches knowing that they are unlikely to come back. And I think the thing we might be about to discover is that given that the current composition of the Conservative Parliamentary Party and how much more rebellious MPs are these days compared to in the past, a majority of 80 might not be anywhere as big as it sounds. So, you know, to someone who grew up when I did, the majority of 80 is big. You know, that shouldn't mean any trouble. I think that we might be about to find that in the current political environment, a majority of 80 is not as large as it looks on paper.
And Katie, speaking of spending troubles, has there been any further fallout from the resignation of Kevin Collins, the government's catch-up czar, after he resigned yesterday?
I think there's a bit of a blame going on in terms of who is behind this, and lots of criticism being thrown at the Chancellor, blame at the Treasury, and questions over Rishi Sunak's judgment. I think in terms of where this goes, however, there is a strong signal from Downing Street, and we heard it, I think, slightly from ministers out this morning doing broadcast, that there is more funding to come. And therefore, I think that is keeping, I suppose, unrest or concern in the Tory party fairly at bay. You definitely have some figures such as Rob Halfen, chair of the Education Select Committee, coming out to voice concern. But I think generally speaking, everyone expects that there will be more, not the £15 billion levels that the former leader of the catch-up force wanted there to be, but enough that they will have something to show for it.
Katie and James, thanks very much. And join us again for our next episode tomorrow. And remember, if you like this podcast, do rate and review us.